Monster Man, special episode, Doppelgangers. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. And in particular, Patreon backer Andrew Sadlowski, who asked me to talk about the doppelganger in Dungeons & Dragons. If you'd like to be like Andrew and get your very own special episode about a monster of your choice, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to a special episode, you'll also get access to my other show, Patron Deities, which is about the Deities and Demigods book and how to use religion and mythology in your fantasy role-playing games. We're just about to start a season on D&D's coverage of Native American myths and legends, and it's gonna be interesting. I'm quite looking forward to it. Maybe not in like a joyful way, but I think we're going to learn a lot.
I certainly am.
Plus the bonus content that goes out to my patrons at all levels. So, Andrew, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy your episode. Let's talk doppelgangers. So the term doppelganger is German, and it means a double goer or double walker. Interestingly, the folkloric or literary doppelganger, which originates maybe in like the 18th century, the folkloric or literary doppelganger is not really the creature that we see in Dungeons & Dragons. This is a case of a similar term being adopted to apply to a creature that is quite different. And I think the D&D creature is actually probably more useful in its kind of pulp archetype version rather than the literary doppelganger. The original meaning of doppelganger is more like how it would be used in everyday speech. So your doppelganger is just somebody who looks a lot like you, or indeed looks identical to you. But it isn't what the creature is in Dungeons and Dragons, which is a shapeshifter. In D&D, the doppelganger can change its appearance to look like anyone. Normally, the spirit or evil twin or just other person described as a doppelganger in fiction is someone that looks like a specific other person. And sometimes the appearance of a doppelganger is a bit like the appearance of Icelandic folk belief, but certainly in the Icelandic sagas, you have what's called a philia, a fetch. And that's a sort of spirit that's associated with a person. And so if you see that, certain people can see them, and sometimes they appear at like moments of crisis. And a lot of the time, if you see someone's philia, it's a bad sign. Like, for example, you know, so seeing someone's doppelganger might mean that they're about to die, or at least that something dramatic is about to happen to them or with them. The idea of the doppelganger appears throughout the literature of the 19th century. So there's an Edgar Allan Poe story, William Wilson, that's all about the idea that the narrator has this kind of other self, you know, that he knows this other person who is also called William Wilson and who kind of resembles him, and how that relationship kind of torments him throughout his life, and also how maybe it's maybe not what he thinks it is. But the modern author that I most associate with the idea of the doppelganger is Gene Wolfe. Questions of like identity and mirroring appear throughout Wolfe's most famous work, The Book of the New Sun, but also in a lot of his other stuff. The idea being that, at least in The Book of the New Sun, the protagonist, Severian, is always being confronted by people who are flawed mirrors of him in some way, you know, who share some characteristic with him. This isn't all that unusual in terms of like a coming-of-age story, but I just think because of the sort of supernatural or science fictional context of that story, it's a lot more pronounced. But although I am going to return to this idea later, for the most part, I don't think that this is how the doppelganger appears in Dungeons & Dragons. I don't think it's how most people use it, and I don't think it's how it's best used. So the doppelganger in Dungeons & Dragons is an intelligent creature capable of adapting itself to look like anyone else. And specifically, in order to avoid discovery, what it'll do is it'll try to kill someone and then take their place. So this seems to me to have two main elements of horror, right? This is a very horror monster. And the first is paranoia. So once you know, like, a doppelganger is something where you almost don't want the twist that there's a doppelganger to be hidden. You want people to know that there is a doppelganger, but not who the doppelganger is. And so then you get that situation where the player characters are getting very paranoid. They're thinking the doppelganger could be any of these people. The doppelganger could be one of us, and we need to come up with some way to make sure that it isn't. which is particularly tricky because doppelgangers are also mind readers. So you don't, they're not perfect, but it's not always the case that you can, you know, ask someone a question only they would know the answer to or something like that. The second frightening thing about a doppelganger is the loss of identity. It's the way in which the existence of the doppelganger threatens your perception of yourself as unique. Obviously, this can be a metaphor for kind of the breakdown of our own solidity of our sense of identity, but it can also be, but in a fantasy setting, that can also be exaggerated by the idea that there could genuinely, literally be someone who's out there impersonating you. And this, I think, is an idea that is best expressed in games where the player characters have pretty frequent interaction with a recurring group of NPCs, because that kind of emphasizes the ways in which we define ourselves to some extent by how others react to us. I'll return to that point in a moment. And in addition to these two main points, I think there's an important question about the doppelganger, which is, what does it want? And I think that that's quite ambiguous for reasons that we'll discuss in a moment. So let's return to our first point, the idea of paranoia. The doppelganger could be anyone. Paranoia seems like the obvious tack to take with the doppelganger, right? It's got that kind of Cold War aspect to it, or an intrigue aspect. Anyone could be the traitor. Anyone could be the assassin. So, for example, in the film The Thing, they know that The Thing can shapeshift, and so they're panicking about, you know, how do they know that one of them is not The Thing? And similar paranoia appears in a lot of science fiction films, actually. And the most obvious example would be something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. This idea that the threat could be among you and people wouldn't even know. Like, how would you persuade people that someone has been replaced with a duplicate? Now, this is very tricky to do with a player character. Let's say you had a player character at the table who was the best sport in the world, and somehow it had happened that their character had died off screen, that the other members of the party had not been present when the character died, and for that matter, that the players had been prevented from finding out about it. And you just gave that player the character sheet of a doppelganger and said, okay, well, you have been replaced by a doppelganger, and, you know, we'll see how long it takes the other player characters to find this out. That's really the only situation in which it could work, because otherwise you wind up with that unfortunate position where the other players, their characters don't know that someone's been replaced by a doppelganger, but the players are perfectly aware of the fact. So I'm not saying that players would, you know, quote-unquote cheat. The level to which you use out-of-game information at the table is just a difference in custom between tables. It's not a question of cheating or not, but quote-unquote cheat and use the fact that their players knew out of character what was going on to have the characters figure it out in character. But it wouldn't be all that much fun, you know, constantly policing yourself to make sure that you don't misuse your out-of-character knowledge is not an enjoyable play experience. This is how I like to view these kinds of things. You know, I played for a long time in games that were very politics-heavy, very intrigue-heavy, where characters had a lot of secrets. And it was not always possible to avoid finding out about them. And when that happened, you sort of put yourself in a disadvantageous position where, because you, out of character, knew what was going on, anytime you had your character sort of twig to what was happening, you could never really be sure whether you had properly figured it out in character or whether you were taking unfair advantage of the fact that you knew about it out of character, which is why, in general, I like to not know things out of character. I phrase this diplomatically to other players by saying that I like to avoid spoilers. Everybody can understand not wanting spoilers. So it was quite challenging to do with a player character, just logistically challenging, in terms of the players at the table is difficult to pull this trick off. But with an NPC, I think it can be quite rewarding, and this works very well if you have the kind of recurring NPCs that the player characters are fond of. Those could be patrons, they could be henchmen, they could be villains even, I mean it could be whoever, as long as the players are attuned enough to who that NPC is that they would notice differences in them, even if they notice them gradually over time. So if your characters return to a home base and the same NPCs are there every time, you know, if they go back to the village, if they go back to the castle, and the bartender or the old druid or the seneschal or whoever is starting to act a little funny, I think that can be a good way to introduce a doppelganger. Now, there you have multiple ways to do this. You know, some people don't do a lot of, like, performance at the table, and I find that When you, I'm a very theatrical GM, I guess, but I find that when you want to convey that sort of thing, you always have to exaggerate a bit more than you think you do, because when you are playing all the characters, they all have a tendency to sound like each other a little bit, because, you know, I'm not the world's greatest actor or anything. So players might not pick up on subtle variations in a performance because they might assume that they are just normal variations in performance. You know, my character's accents slip or whatever. So you might have to kind of, like, put your finger on the scales a little bit to make something big enough for the players to see. If you don't do the voices or whatever, the easiest way to do it is to have the doppelganger not know something that the NPC would have known, or, more likely given the doppelganger's abilities, know something that the NPC wouldn't know, and then the player characters start to twig that something's going on with the doppelganger. In terms of the loss of identity, again, this is more of a challenge to do at the table because the player characters are very seldom going to be confronted by the doppelganger, or at least, You know, one way to make the conflict of the loss of identity work is to have it not be the case that the rest of the party doesn't know that one of the players is a doppelganger, but for all the party to learn that there is a doppelganger or doppelgangers out there. So you go back to the village and the bartender says, well, the last time you were here, you said this. And you say, no, I didn't. I haven't been here since we set off to find the Blue Jewel. And he goes, what are you talking about? You were in here just yesterday. And so you know that the doppelganger is out there. And then you have the task of proving, not to the other PCs, but to the NPCs out there, which of you is real and which of you is the doppelganger. And that way you can do the pointing Spider-Man bit. You know, you can do the bit where you have two characters pointing at each other going, no, shoot him, no, shoot him. And you can confront the player character with the fact that the NPCs are surprisingly taken in by the imposter. Which is a little bit of a blow to the sense of identity, right? Like, I would like to think that I'm a distinctive enough person that if I was replaced by some kind of shapeshifter, people would notice. I wouldn't be me. I wouldn't have all the unique qualities that make me me. But how much do other people really pay attention to those qualities? It can harm our self-regard. And I think this is one of those mysteries that is more effective if you build it up gradually over time. Now, the nature of that mystery depends on the final question that I asked, which is, what do doppelgangers want? Because the doppelganger, as presented in the Monster Manual, seems to me to be the least effective version of the doppelganger. Like, he's just hanging around dungeons waiting for people to assassinate and replace. No, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think there are a number of different plausible motivations for the doppelganger. I'm going to focus on four here. The first is the doppelganger as secret agent. So the doppelganger is a supernatural creature, but effectively, this is merely the kind of magical equivalent of being a master of disguise. The purpose of the doppelganger is to impersonate others. It is a spy. It's an assassin. It's been sent by someone, and that someone could be perfectly mundane. The next kingdom over have decided to spy on this kingdom, and they've sent this person to impersonate you. The Dark Lord from whom you stole the Blue Jewel is fed up with your nonsense and has decided to hire the most expensive assassin in all the realm to take you out. There are lots of examples of this character in fiction, right? The shape-shifting mercenary, or the illusionist mercenary. So Mirror Master in DC Comics would be an example of this. Or he's not a shapeshifter, but he's an illusionist. Or Double Trouble in She-Ra, where the sort of ambiguity of the character's identity extends to ambiguity of their loyalties. That, you know, just as they can shift between a variety of appearances, they can also shift between loyalties, and that doesn't seem out of character for them. The doppelganger is not like you. So I think that that's probably the simplest doppelganger, and it's one where the doppelganger's motivations fit in well with the kind of paranoia theme, because the idea of paranoia and the idea of sort of a spy story go hand in hand. Trying to figure out who's the mole is an existing kind of spy theme, so then if we have, you know, the idea that appearances can be deceiving, the idea that you don't know who to trust, those are core parts of the espionage genre. So if we're going to introduce the doppelganger like an espionage character, that makes perfect sense. The second is your kind of stalker idea. And this, you can go back actually and listen to the old My Favorite Monster special, where Chris and I talked about the monster, the Karma Chameleon, and that's basically a doppelganger-like character where is essentially a stan. It's a super fan, a stalker, who decides that its goal is to become more like a player character and sort of eventually replace them. Or at least that's the interpretation I put on it. There, I think there's actually a more detailed explanation in the Lasers and Liches setting for why that creature is the way it is, but that's what we discussed. And I think that works really well, right? The idea that if you have player characters who kind of outsize personalities, a doppelganger might be a thing that just doesn't have much of an identity or personality of its own. It's kind of a personality vampire. It needs to take yours in order to have one. And obviously you can't both have the same one, so then it's going to get rid of you. But maybe if you have a character who's just sort of famous, a character who's larger than life, a character who's notorious, you know, it could be good or bad, right? It could be like those people that write letters to serial killers in prison. The doppelgangers become obsessed with some great villain or some great hero and just decided, I'd like to be that guy, you know. We all look up to people and think we'd like to be like them, but if you were a doppelganger, then you could just be them if you wanted to. Or maybe they're just lazy, you know, maybe they just want to live a life of riches and fulfillment. I'd like to be the prince. I'd like to live in a big house and sleep in a big fancy bed and go to concerts and hunting and balls and feasts and have all the prettiest girls in the realm want to marry me. Like, that would be fantastic to be the prince. I'll go stab him in the neck and take his appearance. You know, it could be as simple as the player characters show up at the castle and they're like, ah, oh prince, we brought you the blue jewel that you asked for. Is it now time to prevent the Dark Lord from covering all the lanes in a second darkness? And the prince goes, yeah, just check it on the pile, I guess. I'm sorry, your highness, the pile? You know, leaving the castle laden with lavish gifts and going, there's something very wrong with that guy. That's motivation number two, right? What if doppelgangers crave identities? They just don't really have them. The third version of the doppelganger, and this is a bit going back a little bit more toward the folkloric or literary doppelganger, is the idea that a doppelganger is like a curse that someone puts on you, or a curse that your own behavior manifests, right? It's some kind of supernatural manifestation, a bit like you have an evil twin or something like that. You know, maybe you have an artifact. Maybe there's a cursed mirror that produces an evil version of you. I always like the kind of folkloric beginnings of these things, you know, that it is really... I was quite disappointed that the monster, the shadow, in Dungeons & Dragons isn't literally someone's shadow that's gone off to go create havoc. In Vampire the Requiem, you know, most vampires have weird reflections, but they do have reflections. But there are some vampires who have no reflection, and there's an implication that somewhere out there, their reflection is off getting up to trouble. I like that idea. So maybe a doppelganger is a curse that's put on you to punish you, or to kind of, now, I've read this, I don't know anything about real police work, but according to mystery writers, there's a thing that you can do called snitch jacketing or bad jacketing somebody. So let's say that you're a detective and you want someone to inform on their colleagues in organized crime, but they don't want to do it because they know that bad things happen to people who inform. You set things up so that it looks like they have informed. So now the gang won't protect them anymore. In fact, the gang is out to get them, so they turn to the only place that they can, which is the police. So by making it look like they had done something wrong by the gang's code of behavior, you make it more likely that they actually will do it. That seems like maybe a very irresponsible thing to do with human lives, but for our purposes, you know, for a detective novel or a role-playing game, I think it's a really interesting idea. So the doppelganger in sort of version 4 could be someone's tactic to frame you. That's more of a straight-up minion version of the doppelganger, right? That it's been created or summoned or whatever by the Dark Lord, and it's there to lure you onto, you know, so it's not like a freelance mercenary like in version 1. It's almost like a creation of the bad guy. Maybe something that was done to someone, and it's trying to lure people in to serve the Dark Lord, whether that's by looking like their kindly old mentor and advising them that it's the right thing to do, or by looking like them framing them for a crime so that they become an outlaw. Incidentally, getting framed by a crime and having to go on the lam, like go on a period of outlawry, is a great experience for player characters, if you're playing that kind of game, right? It explains their life of rootless wandering. So version number 4 of the doppelganger is that it's essentially like a magical process. You know, it's not a curse directed at you. It's not like a mercenary working for the highest bidder. It's just something that the boss monster can do to get people to do what they want. So the doppelganger is one of those D&D monsters that I think has a tremendous amount of potential, but actually, in the monster manual, you know, you really have to kind of dig to find that potential. You have to think quite hard to make the doppelganger make sense, because a lot of the time you're just, you know, oh, there are two doppelgangers in this room of the dungeon. Doing what? waiting for a bus? Like, why are they just hanging out in basements? Now, before I go, I want to talk about the... I usually don't like to do this kind of prescriptive thing, but here is how not to use the doppelganger. The doppelganger should not be a gotcha suckers monster. You gotta play fair when you introduce a character who has the ability to impersonate someone. You gotta leave clues. Because otherwise, what you get is, well, you hear the sound of crying coming from the jail cell. Oh, I'll open the door and look in. Oh, well, there's a little girl, and she's holding onto her teddy bear, and she's weeping. Like, oh, there, little one. I know you're stuck down in this rotten dungeon. Why don't you come with us, and we'll get you out of here. Haha, sucker, it turns into a doppelganger and attacks you. Oh, right. Well, okay, next time I'll leave the little girl in the jail cell. Those kinds of trap monsters teach lessons. I've talked about this before. And the lesson that they teach the player characters is they motivate them to do the thing that you don't want player characters to do, which is nothing. They motivate the player character to do nothing. I'm not going in there. It's an obvious trap. That's no fun. So when you have a doppelganger, it's much more fun if you're playing a deadly game of cat and mouse, but Total Stranger just turns out to be a monster and shanks you in the back is not a deadly game of cat and mouse. It's a landmine. And that's the least entertaining form of trap. It's not a puzzle. It's not a test. It's not a challenge. It's not fun. It's just a big heck you. So avoid that if I were you. All right. Andrew, I hope that you enjoyed this episode about doppelgangers. It was a lot less folklore and literature heavy than the one about Jin, but that's really because the doppelganger of the game is so different from the other one, and yet I think so full of interesting game possibilities. Once again, if you would like to be like Andrew and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and we're going to talk about the Wretch Plant and the Rock Reptile on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.